We spent a few days this summer at the beach, which is not something we get to do often, and we spent those days, you know, doing what you do at the beach, digging in the sand and eating popcorn that had gotten sandy on it and so was sort of gross, and roasting ourselves golden brown, all the things that you do. And my daughter, who is an early riser, she and I would wake up in the morning, way before dawn, and we would make our way down to the beach, and for a little while before breakfast, we could stand on that sandy beach and we could look out over the water before anybody else came down there with their coolers and their Kindle e-book readers and their little dogs and their spray-on sunscreen. We could stand there, just us, with the sun coming up and our backs to the whole world, and we could see that ocean in as close to its natural state as I'm ever going to see it. And of course, it was enormous. Wave after wave, inexorably crawling onward, hit this beach. Water that had touched another continent touched our toes, and that riotous color that comes with an early morning dawn over the ocean greeted us. And in moments like that, it's hard not to have deep thoughts. Until, of course, my daughter screamed and tried to tackle a seagull, but you know, still, out of that vastness, in those moments I thought that we were tiny in the face of the great ocean. And of course, this sort of beach, this place that gives rise to such thoughts, has a dramatic landscape to match the ocean stretching before it. This particular beach butted up against steep cliffs on the landward side. It was the kind of place that you could only access by walking really carefully down these little staircases that families had built into the cliffside over the generations. And if you put your back to the ocean and you look toward the land, all you saw were these little lines of ladders stretching out like zippers on the cliffside in front of you. They were steep and they were sometimes wobbly, and they served as the only access points for generations of these families who came here for their summer getaways. And it seemed to me that the stories of families were told on each of those staircases. You know what a house that's slowly moldering into nothingness looks like? You gaze on it and you can't help but think of the children who grew up there, of the man and the woman who put their lives into building it, of the grandmas who spent their final days there. You can't help but try to tell the stories of those around whom that old house reached its creaky arms and held tight. And some of the stairways along that cliffscape were so long neglected that they hardly looked like man-made structures anymore. You know, they were the kind of thing that started to melt into some organic element reclaimed by the sand and the ocean and the weeds. And I had this sense that if I stood there long enough, all of it would be covered up and there would just be sand and sea and time. Layer upon layer of eternity piling up on those stories, obscuring what was once some child's happiest summer memory, what was once some family's pride and joy. Pondering those overgrown staircases, I wondered how long those old structures would be visible above the sand at all, if in time anyone would remember that they even existed. And this is, after all, a good thing and a bad thing, isn't it? The land covering over all the marks we make on it. Time and the hour run through the darkest day, and the sea reclaims all things. Every poem ever written about nature and our feeble efforts to hold out against it points to that truth. But we human beings have archaeologists among us. And it is in the nature of an archaeologist to dig underneath all those layers. Excavation is an effort to find what now seems lost, to look once again upon what was forgotten, and those lost stairways on a windswept landscape got me thinking about all the layers of time and memory and loss and general crap, the sand and weeds of the spirit that all of us might pile up on top of ourselves over the years. What if I were to excavate my soul? What if I were to go down deep in the basement of my being and commence digging? What if I could dig underneath all the layers that time and struggle and yearning had given me, all the layers underneath which my being is obscured, and find something essential there, something elemental, something true? Of course, if one were to excavate an old forgotten staircase, what you would find is a staircase, a useful object meant for a purpose, not good, not bad, but useful. What would you find if you dug underneath the layers of a person? What would you find if you excavated my soul? Something good under there? Something bad? Something useful? Or nothing at all? What is the essence of a human being beneath all of our layers? What is left of the true self to which we might return? The truth is that philosophers and theologians have been debating this for thousands of years, and nobody has reached an adequate conclusion. But every time I think about human nature, I am forced to come back to my good old frenemy, Plato. And I call Plato my frenemy because I feel like he and I have had a somewhat contentious relationship over the years. When I was in college, it was actually one of my jobs to tutor the Xavier University basketball team in reading philosophy for their required freshman philosophy course. And the first thing they had to read was Plato's Republic. So I spent hours of college trying to dig with these basketball players through Plato just enough that they could pass the exam and then forget it all. And at the time, I kind of liked old Plato. But I found over the years that I have a few bones to pick with the man. Because, you see, Plato, often considered the most influential of the philosophers to lead us toward what we know as the Western tradition, he lived in the 4th century BC, so 4 centuries before Jesus ever existed, etc., etc. Anywho, Plato basically believed that we human beings would be a heck of a lot better off if we could just get rid of this meat sack we are walking around in and allow ourselves to be pure spirit. If we could just abandon this broken, wrinkly thing that we have been given as a body and aspire to be purely, elementally spirit. Now, this was way before you ever had any Christian ideas of who God was or who human nature was. Plato was very definitely a pagan, but one of the things he did articulate was a belief in one God, not several gods, not a pantheon of gods, but one God, and that the spirit, the non-visible, the stuff of the air was the stuff of God. And all of this hair and bones and skin and blood, all of this was not God's, but someone else's entirely. So what Plato did was invent for the Western world what one might call the concept of dualism. He created this big old cleaving between the stuff of God and the stuff of the earth. And in a dualistic worldview, we're all just waiting to step out of this stupid mortal coil in which we've been stuck and go winging back to our true oneness with God. Which means most of the stuff we spend doing with these bodies, most of the time that we spend with one another, most of that is morally questionable or at least dangerous to one's soul. Classic dualisms, God versus man, heaven versus earth, soul versus body, ideal versus object. So see, if we're good Platonists, what we really need to do is get rid of all these layers of damned human experience. You see why I have some bones to pick with them? If we're good Platonists, what we really need to do is get rid of the taste of strawberries. What we really need to do is get rid of the need to touch another person. Get rid of the stupid hair that is always tangled, and these terrible feet with their toenails that always grow, and these bodies that get sick and turn to dust and die. If we are true Platonists, what we should yearn for is to get rid of the whole expanse of human experience in this world and focus instead on our true spiritual nature that lies beneath all of this. Underneath it all, he said there was a soul, and it had nothing to do with all this bone and blood that covers it. Now fast forward a few centuries. And the Christian philosophers like St. Thomas Aquinas, taking inspiration from Plato and his pals, found a great deal of resonance in my old frenemies' ideas. And they extended them one step beyond to a logical conclusion. You see, if our original souls are pure and of God, and yet this flesh sack here that we're stuck in is dirty and impure, what the heck happened between then and now? How did we get from there to here? Give St. Augustine a crack at that question, and what emerges over the years is the concept of original sin. Namely, that after the fall, after Adam and Eve messed up, we covered up our godly blessedness with sinful willfulness. We clothed our naked spiritual soul in the filth of flesh and body, and we walked away from that garden eternally lesser than we had been before. It follows in this theology that unless we repent, what exists deep down inside, underneath all of our layers, is a broken thing, begging only to be redeemed. And so, in this very common narrative, one should not really dare to excavate too deeply into one's own soul. One should not really try to uncover what lies within, because what lies within is kind of bad. And only God's grace can choose to heal our brokenness, and God never offered any guarantees. So for centuries, the concept of digging deeply into the heart of a human being has frightened the Western world, and the church has become, at times, the place you go to make amends for your brokenness, to turn your back on this sinful body, this filthy thing, and come once again to know the purity of a heavenly realm. And I heard an anecdote once about this church in Texas, where the church sign outside the church doors said, "Done with sin? Come on in," in these big, bright, all caps letters. And written below that in lipstick said, "But if you're not quite finished, call 555. This is what we have created of the church, a classic dualism. There's the church, the place you go to protect yourself from your brokenness, and there's the world, that broken and terrible place written in red lipstick, calling you back outward to all that awaits. But that's not all that people have ever thought of church. That's certainly not all we think of church. These dualisms, church and society, the pure ones and the sinful ones, dualisms all over the moral landscape, they have even shaped how we speak about ourselves. Think about it, that our language reflects this dualism. After all, we're only human, aren't we? A tightrope walker stumbles and, well, he's only human. The brilliant mathematician forgets to carry a 9 and he's only human. Mother forgets to fold the laundry and, you know, I'm only human. As if being a human being is a bad thing. As if the very definition of humanity itself revolves around our inherent failure to be perfect. From Plato's dualism, to Augustine's original sin, to our own absent remarks when we spill a glass of milk, the deep-seated idea of the brokenness of human nature has trickled down the ages. And even those among us who have rejected the whole concept of eternal fall and redemption ages ago still often find it difficult to look down deep inside and dare to risk an honest look at what we might find there. But of course, that brokenness is not the only interpretation of human nature. There are other theologians and philosophers and preachers and poets who say that human nature is not inherently bad or sinful, and if we dig down deep underneath all these layers life has piled up on us, there are those who say we will find there not inherent brokenness, but inherent blessedness. Not original sin, but original blessing. The most eloquent of those theologians in recent decades has been Matthew Fox. And if you go and Google Matthew Fox, you will find this handsome actor who was on Lost, and I'm not talking about that guy. I am talking about a renegade Dominican priest who said that our real task, and indeed our real challenge as human beings, is to face down the reality of our own astonishing beauty. The fact that we are born blessed beyond measure, and that our very original blessedness exists underneath all of our cynicism, our shame, our heartbreak, and our fear, that fact that we are not, as Fox says, mere blotches on existence, but newborn hope, burst into this world as an original blessing, is sometimes just as difficult to comprehend as brokenness. To Fox and his fellow theologians, our inherent goodness, all we have to do to see it is to live in our true selves, and that must be the hardest work of all. Because, he admits, there are external forces that do everything possible to separate us from that jewel of inherent blessedness we're born with, we can twist our inherently good desire for love into a kind of bitter demand for praise and recognition. We can put one layer over top of our pure souls by twisting our inherently good desire for safety into a shriveled up self-protection, piling on fear that conceals the treasure of our being. We can turn love into hate, passion into anger, humility into guilt, and each of those choices just puts one more layer atop the big old sand pile that separates us from the original blessedness of our birth. To excavate those layers would involve a willingness to heal what we ourselves have broken. From a Buddhist perspective, it would involve first acknowledging that those layers of fear and attachment and pain exist, and then quietly removing them one by one, as long as it takes, till we get back to where we started from in the first place. Therapy is a kind of excavation of the soul. At its best, religion and spiritual practice is a kind of excavation. Anything that helps us name what covers our original blessedness is an archaeological dig, pulling away one layer after another in the tedious work of becoming more completely ourselves. It is work that is never done, this excavation. And though I really do want to believe, like Matthew Fox, that there is a jewel there underneath all of my layers, I have to admit that I'm a little bit too cynical or too realistic for all that. And both ideas, that a human being is born fully broken or fully blessed, both of them are a little too simple, aren't they? They smack of the same old dualism I've been griping about from my frenemy Plato. I suspect that human nature is more complicated than either of those theological camps would hold, and in its own way, more holy. Imagine the beach again. The sand and the weeds and the stone piling up age after age on that meager man-made structure built many summers ago. Imagine 20 years, 200 years of time doing what it does. Imagine some soul walking out over windswept hills that look over the ocean beyond. She might have a seat on that windswept hill. She might take in the view. She might rest a while and never know that underneath her very feet, obscured by layer upon layer, there was neither a dark place nor a jewel, but a staircase, a journey, a way forward, a path. If you could excavate an old, forgotten staircase, what you would find there is a staircase, a useful object meant for a purpose. neither good nor bad, but useful. What would you find if you dug underneath the layers of a person? What would you find if you excavated my soul? Something good under there? Something bad? Something useful? A way forward, a means to travel further than my current comfortable resting spot, an instrument for the continuing journey. So often I believe that we are that traveler, sitting out on that windswept bluff, enjoying the ocean, either comfortable or bitterly chafing at this resting spot we're stuck in. And all the while, we are unaware that underneath every layer, all of it, there lies a staircase that leads to the sea. A journey yet to be taken. An invitation to rise from whatever place we currently rest and begin something new. For thousands of years, philosophers and theologians have debated this point: what is the essence of a human being? What is the substance of a soul? I think it is an instrument for transformation. It is an invitation to keep learning, keep moving, keep getting closer and closer to the infinite. It is a staircase too long obscured, or a staircase shining and newly painted, waiting for your footsteps. Either way, the journey awaits, and under it all, should we dare to excavate our lives, should we care to pull away layer after layer of pain and hurt and time, we might discover that the journey is never done. Do not rest too long, dear friends. Do not rest in either your delight or your sorrow, for beneath your very life there may well be a staircase that leads on. Underneath your every pain and joy, the path moves forward, and only you can uncover it and walk it for yourself. Mm-hmm.